The cruelest trick of nature is simply this. After we've been working for a few hours, or at the end of a long day, when blood sugar levels are at their lowest, our brains abandon us and leave us incapable of making a wise choice about what to eat. Which brings us back to our dieters in those first few weeks of January. They start each day with good intentions. They exercise, which depletes their willpower. They have an average day, meaning, whether at home with kids or at work, they are emotionally regulating themselves, which depletes their willpower. They check their email, and they are resisting near constant temptations to eat. By the time dinner rolls around, many of them will turn to their spouse and say, "Let's just order a pizza," and not even know why. They've just fallen into the willpower gap. How many times have you started the day with great intentions only to end up ordering takeout for dinner because you were exhausted? You tell yourself, "Oh, well, I'll just start again tomorrow." Or you've been working on a report for a few hours and then you find donuts in the break room. If you eat them, it's not because you're weak. It's because you're normal. Since resisting temptation is one of the key things that does deplete willpower, Roy Baumeister and one of his graduate students wondered how much time people actually spend doing just that. So they decided to find out. With a colleague in Germany, W. Hoffman, they gave subjects beepers and then paged them 7 times each day at random intervals and asked, "Hey, what are you doing right now? Are you resisting some kind of desire or craving? If so, what for?" From the 205 male and female participants, they gathered over 7,827 momentary reports. The data were staggering. And they showed that people spend, on average, 4 hours a day resisting some kind of desire or craving. Sleep, leisure, sex, checking Facebook. These all ranked. But the number one desire people spent their energy resisting? Food. By far. It's the number one thing we want. We think about it hours more every day than our brains have the capacity to resist it. It's everywhere, and giving in is socially acceptable, unlike walking out of work to catch a movie or having sex with our cubicle mate, other popular desires. Now you're starting to see why the idea that someone could lose weight just by willing it is pretty ludicrous. There are things we can do to replenish our stores of willpower. Glucose restores it, prayer, meditation, social connection, sleep, and gratitude restore it too, which is helpful. But scientist Brian Wansink calculated that we make, on average, 221 food-related choices each day. Yeah, 221. Now, even falling into one or two small willpower gaps would be enough to create a weight loss plateau. And most of us are not falling into small willpower gaps. We are falling into canyons, the kind that completely derail our weight loss efforts and send us back to square one, over and over and over again. Diet programs that focus extensively on how to exercise and what not to eat, but fail to incorporate a program of behavioral intervention to bridge the willpower gap, are doomed to be ineffective. What you need is a plan that assumes you have no willpower at all, because at any given moment you may not, and works anyway. Brightline eating is designed to take the burden off willpower. No matter how much you know about nutrition, you will never succeed if you're making your food choices on the fly. Bridging the willpower gap is essential, and that's what Chapter 6 is all about. In Chapter 6, I'm going to teach you the techniques that are the bedrock of Brightline eating, techniques that helped one of my dearest friends, Pat Reynolds, lose 190 pounds in 14 months and keep it off. Most importantly, you're going to stop thinking you're weak-willed. You've just been relying on a part of your brain that can't shoulder that kind of responsibility, period. But no worries, we're going to solve that too.
Case study. Lynn Colston. Highest weight, over 250 pounds. Current weight, 103 pounds. Height, 5 feet, 2 inches. It's hard to believe, but I was a really skinny kid. However, for the past 35 years, I have gained and lost and gained and lost, tried every diet and always gained the weight back. I tried the macrobiotic diet, the grapefruit diet, HCG, gallons of Slim Fast, gallons of water, Weight Watchers, raw vegan, too many diets, and way too much exercise to remember. Sometimes I got thin. At my lightest, my wedding day, I got down to a size 5 by starving myself and taking X-lax. I was miserable, but I was thin. I tried to use that same method time and again after that, but I could never get the same results. And the worst part was that it usually took just 3 weeks after getting thin for me to eat my way back up to and right past my previous weight. Over the following years, I ate whenever I felt emotional stress, from the vending machine at jobs where I felt insecure, as I grieved when my doctor told me that I would never have children, when I was stressed out about school, and when I tried to save my poor mother's life. After her death, I stopped caring about myself completely. At my heaviest, I weighed over 250 pounds. It was at that point that I stopped weighing myself. I cried myself to sleep at night and was always astonished when I woke up still fat. It was as if I thought something would magically remove the pounds. I coped with the disappointment by eating more. I would fill the biggest mixing bowl I have with popcorn, drown it in a bottle of agave syrup, and add lots of salt. Believe it or not, I thought of it as healthy caramel corn. My worst food habit was regularly going to Taco Bell for 3 orders of the Taco 12-pack. I would eat 1 pack all by myself in the car, and then bring the other 2 home for my husband and me to eat. My husband is 6'1". I finished mine, but he could only eat half a pack at a time. Eventually, my knees hurt so badly that I couldn't get down the stairs. My husband had to bring food up to me to eat. It was humiliating and painful. I had neuropathy in my toes. I'm sure I was borderline diabetic, but I wouldn't go to the doctor. When I did go out once for a funeral, I had to leave my skirt unzipped and hope that my fat would hold it up. Then I became vegan, and eventually I got down to 150 pounds. I was glad, but still perpetually embarrassed by the apron of fat around my waist that hung down over my thighs. I thought about my weight all the time, and the despair made me eat foods that would make me start gaining again. I felt completely wrapped up in my food. Then someone on one of my vegan websites mentioned Brightline eating. I watched the introductory videos, and I've never looked back. With Brightline eating, I lost those last 50 pounds. I'm a comfortable size 0, and I easily fit into my wedding dress. I've been on maintenance for a while now, and am beginning to realize that I can finally trust that I will keep the weight off. Best of all, I feel very relaxed about food since I know exactly what I'm going to eat, and know that it will keep me at my goal weight. I no longer have neuropathy. My body fat is 17%. My resting heart rate is 50. My average blood pressure is 90 over 60. I am on no medication, and I ran a marathon in January. Slowly, but I ran it. Also, I used to be filled with self-loathing and self-doubt. I was chronically depressed. Now I have a completely different and confident self-image, and I'm not at all depressed. But my biggest reward from Brightline eating was freeing my mind up to think about things besides food. There's nothing like knowing that I will always be able to stay at the weight I want. There is a formula, and it works, and it will always work. I am so incredibly grateful for my new way of life.
Chapter 2. Insatiable Hunger. So now, having read Chapter 1, you understand that you are not weak-willed. You are a human being with a human brain. Weakness has nothing to do with it, and programs that rely on your willpower, in the long term, are dooming you to failure. The scientific fact is that limitations arising from the way willpower is wired in the brain, combined with the stressors and pace of our modern world, leave you vulnerable to unhelpful food choices. And those unhelpful food choices set off a cascade of activity in the brain that creates two things: insatiable hunger and overpowering cravings. That's what we're going to talk about in the next two chapters. Both of these are new phenomena, historically speaking. Hunger is not new, of course. Hunger is a vital human drive that ensures our survival. What's new is that food is ever available and food is heavily processed. And this turns out to have interesting and pretty dire consequences. It warps our natural motivation to eat and morphs it into an entirely new sort of beast. For the majority of human history, food was scarce. We had to eat whatever we could, whenever we could get it, whenever it was ripe or whenever we had just run fast enough to catch it. We are built to go stretches of time without food because frequently we had to. Our bodies quickly adapt to food shortages by lowering our basal metabolic rates and slowing down our functioning to make do with less. In the total absence of food, the body runs on stored glucose for up to 3 days, and then the liver begins to break down the body's fat stores and muscle tissue so that we can keep going. After a few weeks of starvation, the organs themselves start breaking down and turning into fuel. Even during normal weight loss, attempts to burn more calories through vigorous exercise result in a reduced resting metabolic rate. In short, the body is skilled at adapting to survive until food can be found again. What it's poor at adapting to, it turns out, is a nonstop smorgasbord of calories. And not just any calories, heavily processed and refined calories. Nowhere in our evolution did the human animal have to contend with this. But it's exactly what our modern food systems and patterns of eating provide: an ever-present glut of processed and refined calories. The obesity rates we're seeing are a visual representation of the collective shock our bodies are in from what's being poured into them. And what has this done? It's broken our brains. Insatiable hunger. So, what do I mean by insatiable hunger? Evolutionarily speaking, it's a new kind of hunger. It's not, give me fuel to start my day. It's, I just ate dinner and a whole bag of chips, and now I'm heading to the freezer for ice cream. Insatiable hunger. When I think about it, I remember many times where, as I was ordering dessert after a big meal, or as I was heading back to the kitchen for thirds or fourths, I would check in with my body and ask it whether it was hungry. The resounding response was, no. But my brain quickly shut down that thought because it was irrelevant and threatening even. I needed more food. Insatiable hunger had taken over and there was no stopping it. Now, scientists have noticed that this urge I remember so vividly differs from real hunger in two key ways. The first unusual thing is that it's accompanied by a strong urge to be sedentary. Think of our modern activities: eating in front of the TV, eating while reading a book, eating while checking email or surfing the web, eating at a sporting event, eating at the movies, eating in our cars. And those aren't even meals. Those are typically between-meal snacks we've sanctioned. We have turned life into a buffet, a continuous, sedentary buffet. And I'm making a point of this because we're going to meet a mouse later who is our rodent counterpart. Now, historically, evolutionarily, this was not the case at all. Having fuel on board used to be a biological trigger to get moving. When the berry bushes were heavy and full, and perhaps someone in our tribe had killed a wildebeest, we'd gorge ourselves for a few days, and then our brains would tell us to go get active. And that was a good thing. It was crucial that we take those calories and use them to ensure our future survival. We had to grow and store more food for the scarce times coming. We had to build some shelter. We had to go find a mate. Fuel used to result in activity, but now it doesn't. It results in sluggishness. The second thing that is different about our modern hunger is that eating doesn't actually satiate it. As I wrote in the introduction, an eating disorder specialist explained to me years ago that overweight subjects report starting to get hungrier at the halfway point of a meal, and they typically end the meal as hungry as when they started. That is the response of a broken feedback mechanism. And to this day, I can completely relate to those findings. I remember when I was obese, I never seemed to get full. Or if I did, it didn't make me want to not eat. I was stuffed, uncomfortably full, but I would just wait 30 minutes for the pain to subside and then keep eating. That is not how we're supposed to operate. There is a mechanism called compensation that's supposed to govern how we regulate our intake of calories. It will be familiar to any parent who's felt like sometimes their kids will eat anything that isn't locked down, and at other times they seem to just live on crackers and air. That's compensation. Research shows that if kids have a lot to eat at one meal, they instinctively decrease intake later, almost calorie for calorie. But we are losing that ability. Professor Brian Wansink, director of Cornell University's Food and Brand Lab, was curious about the cues we use to determine whether we're full. It should be simple, right? Full should be a feeling. Well, he came up with the ingenious idea of testing that idea using self-filling soup bowls. The bowls had hidden hoses attached to the bottom, and for each spoonful the subjects took, the bowls imperceptibly refilled just a little. What happened when an empty bowl was no longer available to cue the participants that they felt full? Well, they consumed 73% more soup than participants who ate from a normal bowl. Yet, when leaving the lab, both groups gave identical ratings for how full they felt and how much soup they guessed they'd eaten. Midway through the experiment, when participants were at the point where they would have emptied one bowlful, had it not been secretly refilling on them, Brian Wansink asked subjects if they were full. They looked down at the still half-full soup bowl and then looked back up at him quizzically, replying, "No, how could I be? I haven't even finished my soup yet." What's this about? How did we get here? What's happening to us? Well, it could be a lot of things, a perfect storm of factors. Dr. Alan Goldhammer is the founder of the True North Health Center and an advocate for plant-based eating. He posits that the increased calorie density of our foods is responsible. Historically, our foods didn't have a very high caloric density. We primarily had access to plants, whole grains, and small amounts of animal protein. If we ate a large quantity of vegetables, we still hadn't taken in very many calories. So the receptors in our stomach lining could easily tell the brain how much fuel we'd just taken in based on how stretched they were. But now we can eat a donut and a drive-through coffee concoction and consume half of our daily caloric needs while barely filling our stomach. Volume of food and calorie consumption are no longer correlated the way they once were. Another culprit could be artificial sweeteners. I'll be talking more about them in Chapter 6, but here are the basics. Artificial sweeteners have no calories, so they give the body nothing to burn for fuel, but they actually impact the insulin system in a very similar way to sugar. The sweet flavor hits the tongue, the receptors in the brain light up, and the pancreas floods the bloodstream with insulin, so we're all ready to process the big bolus of sugar. That never comes. That alone can break the feedback loop. Plus, artificial sweeteners keep us chomping at the bit for something that actually does contain real sugar, and this can result in us overindulging the next time it's available. In 2010, Dr. Terry Davidson and his colleagues in the Department of Psychological Sciences at Purdue University conducted two experiments that showed that rats eating saccharin-flavored yogurt gained about 29% more weight than rats eating glucose-flavored yogurt. Replacing sugar with a non-caloric sweetener had the effect of increasing their appetite for sweet foods later on, and this resulted in weight gain. Meals are another factor. Until recently, meals weren't dictated by a personal schedule. They were dictated by a community's schedule. The tribe ate together to make sure that limited resources were distributed fairly. Before the Industrial Revolution, when life revolved around farming, the family fueled up in the morning, paused their work to eat a large midday meal, and then ate again after dark on their way to bed. Once people moved to factories or mines, shift schedules dictated when employees and sometimes whole towns ate. Now, there is no time of day when it's unacceptable to eat. If a business meeting is before noon, there are Danish pastries on the table. If it's afternoon, there's a tray of cookies. There are donuts in the break room, bagels and cookies at the PTA meeting. Coffee is everywhere all the time, accompanied, of course, by packets of sugar and pots of cream. Every time of day is now a time for food. Our children are the biggest victims of this altered mentality. When my girls were very small and I was taking them to classes, I noticed that after every 30 minutes of tumbling or music, goldfish crackers or raisins would be offered. On all of the college and university campuses where I've taught, students have routinely shown up to class with a snack. And in my psychology of eating class, I would always ask for a show of hands. Who here eats breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day without fail? The students would stare blankly back at me. We don't eat meals anymore. We graze. Yes, all of these factors are playing a role. But something much deeper is also going on. And to understand it, we have to look at how hunger is regulated in the brain. Leptin and the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is an almond-sized area deep inside the brain that contains within it a number of small nuclei with a variety of functions. The hypothalamus is the closest we've got to an internal thermostat. By secreting hormones that in turn stimulate the pituitary gland, it controls hunger, as well as body temperature, parenting attachment, sex drive, thirst, fatigue, sleep, and circadian rhythms. It's an important command center, and a lot of vital things are kept in balance here. It's located just above the brainstem, which we'll talk about in a moment. For now, I want to focus on one hormone in particular and how it affects the hypothalamus's ability to keep our eating in check. That hormone is called leptin. The story of leptin goes way back to 1949, when a few of the mice in a normal weight mouse colony grew up to be very, very different than the rest of their littermates. To the astonishment of the scientists, these strange mice weren't active or curious. They didn't dart around the cage like typical rodents. In fact, they almost never moved. Ever. They didn't move, but they ate. They just sat by the food trough and ate all day long. And even though all they had to eat were generic pellets, they acted like they couldn't get enough of the stuff. Of course, it didn't take long for them to grow to be very, very fat. They loved eating so much that the only way to get those mice to move was to switch the location of the food trough. Then they would waddle slowly over to the new location, plop down, and continue to eat. Now, scientists knew that something important was awry in these special mice, but they couldn't figure out what it was. So they kept the strain breeding until the source of the malfunction could be discovered. Finally, in 1994, after working with these unusual obese mice for 8 years, Jeffrey M. Friedman of the Laboratory of Molecular Genetics at Rockefeller University discovered their issue. Way back in 1949, a spontaneous mutation had deprived the mice of a specific recessive mouse gene, the OB gene. Friedman and his colleagues followed the genetic breadcrumbs and discovered what the OB gene does. It makes a specific hormone. And that hormone's job is to signal to the brain that the mouse needs to stop eating and to get active. Friedman's group called this newly discovered hormone leptin, from the Greek word leptos, meaning thin. Now, were those mice morally defective? Unintelligent? Lazy? Did they need an educational campaign to teach them to eat moderate amounts of food and get their daily exercise? Nope. They just needed some leptin. It turns out that without leptin, the brain thinks it's perpetually starving. It will never believe it's safe to stop eating and to start to move. It's leptin that says, okay, fueling up is over. Go build. Go farm. Go procreate. And sure enough, after they were given a few leptin injections, those mice lost interest in food, started voluntarily climbing into the hamster wheel, and got skinny again. Eureka! Of course, the pharmaceutical industry immediately threw millions at trying to figure out how to manufacture and patent leptin pills. One little pill and all of us humans would soon be able to pull ourselves away from the food troughs and jump on the treadmills. Alas, as fate or biology would have it, leptin in pill form doesn't make an overweight person lose weight. Nor do direct leptin injections. Why not? Well, we don't have the same problem that those mice did. They were completely missing the gene that makes leptin, so they had no leptin at all. We do. In fact, it turns out that overweight people have even more leptin circulating in their blood than skinny people. And this stands to reason, because leptin is produced by fat cells. Leptin is the missing link in our satiety feedback mechanism. When we eat a whole bunch of food, the excess we can't burn immediately goes to our fat cells. And as our fat cells get fuller, they secrete more leptin. The leptin circles back up to the brain and says, okay, no more eating. Go find something useful to do with all this energy. So why is all this leptin swimming in our blood, but not signaling our brains to tell us we're full? What's causing the breakdown in this finely tuned system? The general answer, which scientists have known for years, is that people are becoming leptin resistant, which means their brains are not registering, not seeing the leptin that's circulating in their blood. I certainly remember what that felt like, sitting on the couch night after night, eating, not enjoying it, not even tasting it much of the time, and rarely, if ever, feeling full or satisfied. Just equal parts comforted, numb, and disgusted. So now we ask, what's the underlying cause of leptin resistance? And this, my friends, was the holy grail of obesity research. Solve the puzzle of leptin resistance, and you've cracked the code of the entire obesity pandemic. And not that long ago, it happened. A team at UCSF Medical Center, led by Dr. Robert Lustig, discovered what's causing the widespread epidemic of leptin resistance. The cause, my friends, is insulin. Insulin is blocking leptin in the brain. Insulin. These days, most of us know a bit about insulin. We know it has something to do with diabetes and something to do with sugar levels. And that's a good start. So here's the deal. Our bodies need blood sugar for energy on a cellular level. However, blood sugar can't go directly into most cells. After you eat and your blood sugar level rises, the hypothalamus signals the pancreas to release insulin into your bloodstream. Insulin attaches to cells and tells them to open and absorb the blood sugar, which is why it's often called the key hormone. Insulin can tell your body to use sugar for energy now or to store it for future use. It helps keep blood sugar levels from getting too high, hyperglycemia, or too low, hypoglycemia. Anyone who has read about the surge of type 2 diabetes diagnoses in all developed nations knows that the way our global diet has changed is elevating insulin levels far beyond where our bodies were intended to idle. Research on overweight kids has shown that between grade school and high school, baseline insulin levels rise 45%. We're talking average levels, not the spike that comes from one snack out of a vending machine. The changes in our global diet mean that baseline insulin levels are just too high in practically all of us. Scientists knew that obesity was tied to excess insulin, but until the team at UCSF discovered the link between insulin and leptin, we didn't understand what exactly the excess insulin was doing that was so harmful. But now we know. It's blocking leptin. And in just about the worst place possible, neurologically speaking. The brainstem. We used to think that leptin was being blocked at the hypothalamus, which is true and would be bad enough. But now we know that leptin is also being blocked at another place, the brainstem. The brainstem is sometimes also called the lizard brain. It sits at the base of the brain and is actually structurally contiguous with the spinal cord. Why does it matter that leptin is being blocked at the brainstem? Because this is not one of the parts of the brain that helps us reason, debate, or play out possible scenarios. The brainstem is in charge of things we can't control. Basic things like breathing, swallowing, blood pressure, cardiac functions, and whether we're awake or sleepy. In short, there is no overriding the brainstem. You can try, though, and you might be successful for a hot second. For example, if you walk briskly up 10 flights of stairs, you might decide you're only going to take slow breaths through your nose while you're doing it. You could start out that way, but at some point, your brainstem will take over and demand the oxygen it needs. Like it or not, you will start to breathe heavily. It's not up to you. When it comes to keeping us alive, the brainstem is in charge. And this is where leptin is being blocked. The most primal part of our brain is not getting the hormonal cue that we're full, that we've taken in an adequate amount of food. In those of us with leptin resistance, it is absolutely convinced we are starving. So we sit on the couch as it keeps telling us to eat. And eat. And eat. And what are we eating? What are we reaching for as a global population? Exactly the foods that keep our insulin levels elevated in the first place.
Case study, Lyndon Morris Del Rio. Highest weight, 189 pounds. Current weight, 126 pounds. Height, 5 foot 8 inches. I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, in 1956, the youngest of five children. Our family was quite poor and we didn't have a happy home life. There was a lot of drinking and general dysfunction, and I felt psychologically and physically unsafe most of the time. While I struggled to find normalcy, I was also troubled with having to cope with a relatively minor physical defect. I was born missing all four digits on my left hand. I also turned out to be naturally left-handed. How crazy is that? Still, I excelled at school at an early age and adapted very well physically. But mentally, I found life pretty hard. I had to endure some amount of teasing and nastiness from other children, and between the ages of 8 and 11, I was subjected to inappropriate sexual touching. As I reflect, it comes as no small wonder I sought out substances to help me feel better about myself and my circumstances. Food helped to muffle my inner feelings of lack, disgust, and shame. Since we were poor, our food choices were not the healthiest. We ate biscuits smothered in gravy and big bowls of steamed rice soaked in soy sauce for lunch in the dreary cold prairie winters. I used my church donation money to buy little bags of potato chips on Sundays. But none of it was ever enough to take away the poverty, addiction, or the dark smudge and stain that I felt life had imprinted upon me. In junior high school, I discovered that drugs helped my weight management, and so began decade upon decade of struggles to get my weight down, which I did, but only to gain it back again. Worse yet, the general baseline kept rising with each bout. But I never stopped trying. I was a gym rat, plus did Weight Watchers, blood type diet, paleo, Atkins, low carb, low fat, no fat, Dr. McDougall, Dr. Furman, WFPB, an endless list, really. By 2014, I was thoroughly disheartened and completely disillusioned with myself and with what life seemed to be offering up to me. More than anything, I felt like a fraud and a failure. Sure, I had other successes in my life, but to be frank, I just couldn't fire on all cylinders with the amount of food I was packing away and the food comas induced by my overconsumption. I actually prayed to become bulimic so I could manage my weight gain. Day after long day, I would wake up planning my food binge for later in the day and would go to sleep at night, promising myself that the next day would be different. It never was. When I discovered Brightline Eating, I started with a lot of trepidation at first. But with one 24-hour day on the food plan under my belt, I was off and running. I was engaged, focused, and committed. I stuck to it, with no deviations, until I reached my goal weight. In 6 months, I lost a total of 63 pounds and have been easily maintaining a weight between 125 and 129 for some time now. At 59 years of age, I literally flew by my old notions of an ideal weight. I'm now living at a weight I never would have dared to dream of. On most days, my obsession with food has been lifted. I can wear absolutely anything my heart desires and look pretty fantastic in it. I have also overcome a nearly debilitating heart condition, RVOT. I was experiencing potentially fatal heart events on a regular basis, and they have all but gone away. I have also developed friendships and family here in the Brightline Eating community that I never thought possible. I never imagined I would receive such care and kindness, much less be in a position to so heartily offer the same to others. My work evolved into my current position as the Director of Online Support Community Services, the very place where I found my own ultimate freedom from the tyranny of my obsession with food. Slowly, as time passed and I shed pounds, I started taking steps to advance my painting career, and I love my jazz studies in guitar, cello, piano, and voice, an area where I eventually hope to perform at a professional level. Whatever happens, I'm so up for the journey and the awesomeness of day-to-day life. Everything has changed. I truly feel unstoppable most days. I now embody happy, thin, and free. And I know if I can do this, so can you. Won't you join me? Viva la Brightlines.
Chapter 3. Overpowering Cravings. So, we've learned that we're eating too much of the wrong foods, the foods that cause our insulin levels to rise. The increased insulin blocks leptin, which makes our brains think we're starving. So we're reaching for more food, and our willpower is nowhere in sight because we've used it all up checking email for 15 minutes. Awesome. Now that you understand the willpower gap and the brain malfunction known as insatiable hunger, we're going to talk about the third way our brains block weight loss, overpowering cravings. Now, at first glance, overpowering cravings might seem very similar to insatiable hunger. And it's true that the net result of both of them is that we end up eating more food than our bodies need. But they're not the same thing. So, what's the difference? Essentially, they arise from different mechanisms in the brain. Insatiable hunger originates from the fact that leptin is being blocked at the brainstem, which is what drives people to mindlessly put food in their mouths all day without any ability to get feedback from the body that it doesn't need any more food on board. You might think of this as the grazing or overeating mechanism. Overpowering cravings, on the other hand, are a binging mechanism. They are what make people, myself included, drive miles out of their way for that one specific food, their fix. You can see them late at night in the supermarket, wandering the aisles looking for that thing that will hit the spot. And until they get it, until they can tear open the bag and pop one in their mouth, or sit in the parking lot of the supermarket shoveling food in because they can't stand to wait through the drive home, until they know that release is imminent, their entire body is rigidly focused on one thing, scratching that itch in their brain. But where does that itch originate? The nucleus accumbens. The nucleus accumbens is the seat of pleasure, reward, and motivation in the brain. Inside its outer shell is a cluster of neurons that are activated by dopamine and designed to motivate our behavior, which is why so many life-sustaining activities stimulate the brain to release dopamine, sex, exercise, and yes, eating. In thinking about what's going on in our nucleus accumbens every day, I want to talk specifically about two things, food and sex. We may not generally think of them as being linked, but they're both essential. In order for our species to survive, we've been primed to respond to certain sexual and edible stimuli, sights and smells, with essentially, I want to get me some of that. Interestingly, those stimuli have changed over the years in parallel ways. We simply do not have equivalent food and sexual stimulation available to us as we had 100,000 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, or even 50 years ago. Let's just stay on sex for a moment. If we think about the kind of sexual stimuli that existed a long time ago, we're talking about getting glimpses. If you were lucky and you stumbled upon a river where people from the next community over were bathing, you might catch sight of a naked body at an angle, but you're hiding, you're not that close, and your view would be obscured. In short, you wouldn't have access to much stimulation on call anytime you wanted it. In contrast, the pornography that's available today 24/7 on the internet is grotesquely intense. The brain is no match for that kind of stimuli, for the amount of dopamine that it releases. The brain simply wasn't designed to process a chemical flood of that magnitude. When you start pumping that much dopamine into the nucleus accumbens, it responds by essentially saying, "Whoa, that is really excessive. We don't need anywhere near that kind of stimuli around here." And if you do that over and over again, it adapts by downregulating. Downregulation. Downregulation is the process by which the brain thins out dopamine receptors to adapt to the overload. The next time a similar onslaught comes, its response can be more appropriate. Now that sounds great, except that now you're changing the physiology of the brain. And if the stimulation is not forthcoming, you don't feel very good. What's that like? Well, as a former crystal meth and crack cocaine addict, two substances that practically wipe out the dopamine receptors in the nucleus accumbens, I feel qualified to weigh in here a bit. And what I'll say is this. Using drugs didn't feel pleasurable. Maybe at first, but not after a while. What did it feel like? It felt like more. I just wanted more. But once the dopamine downregulation kicked in, the state I was left in between fixes absolutely felt like the absence of pleasure. Completely and totally bleak. It felt itchy. It felt needy. It felt not okay. And I would have to go to get more, to escape. Not to get high. To get normal. This is something I think a lot of people misunderstand. They think the addict is using to get high, but really the addict is using to get normal. To just be okay for a bit. When we look at food, it's exactly the same story. If you think about the availability and intensity of sweet foods, 100,000 or 1,000 or 50 years ago compared with today, the difference is striking. Take 100,000 years ago. You were lucky when the berry bushes were in season or you could safely get some honey away from the bees. Today, berries are the foods people tell you to eat when you're trying to quit sweets. Refined sugar didn't even enter our diets until the 1700s. It was difficult to access and to process prior to that, so it was reserved for the nobility or people of means. With the advent of the sugar plantation, all that changed. After World War II, we started mechanizing food production. Food became a corporate product with large marketing forces behind it. And then, in 1973, a massive change in U.S. farming subsidy policy brought high-fructose corn syrup onto the scene as an inexpensive sweetener, and consumption increased again. But whether we're talking about high-fructose corn syrup, good old-fashioned table sugar, or any of the dozens of sugars clothed in other names, the reality is that 80% of the calories sold on supermarket shelves are laced with it. It tastes good, and it makes our brain feel good. As a result, over just the last few decades, sugar consumption has skyrocketed to ridiculous levels, and that means that we are hitting the brain with ever higher, more potent levels of stimulation. Stimulation it simply wasn't designed to handle. Cravings. So, that's what's happening in the brain. We're flooding its receptors with dopamine, and they are thinning out. How often does this really happen? Well, think about everything we covered in Chapter 2. Leptin is being blocked in our brain, so we keep going back for more and more food. If someone is eating processed foods at every meal, or even more often, those dopamine receptors are being hit with excessive stimulation every few hours, or more. And of course, there are many other types of stimulation in our modern lives that flood the brain with excess dopamine. Drinking coffee all day, smoking cigarettes, regularly watching pornography, using cocaine or amphetamines, or drinking alcohol. But honestly, just eating a lot of sugar and flour will do it. Yep, when it comes to food, those are the two culprits, sugar and flour. In fact, I want you to consider looking at sugar and flour in an entirely new way. People tend to think of sugar and flour as foods. I invite you to start looking at them as drugs. Sugar and flour in the brain. Picture, if you will, in your mind's eye, four small piles of white substances. Cocaine, heroin, sugar, and flour. I highly recommend you do a Google image search for these substances so you can see with your own eyes what I'm about to describe. It's worth seeing how eerily alike all of these substances look. Now, cocaine, we all agree, is a drug. But how does it become a drug? Where does it come from? Cocaine is derived from the coca leaf, which grows in Colombia and other regions of South America. On their own, coca leaves are pretty harmless. Hikers in the Andes Mountains chew on them all the time. What happens when you put a coca leaf inside your cheek and chew on it? Well, your cheek gets a little numb, and you get a little lift. Maybe like drinking half a cup of caffeinated tea. Does the pleasure that you get from that make you break into your grandmother's house to steal her DVD player so you can buy more coca leaves? No, it doesn't. Coca leaves are not addictive. But when you take the inner essence of those coca leaves and you refine and purify that inner essence into a fine powder, you now have a drug. A very powerful drug. Cocaine. Now, consider heroin. Heroin comes from the poppy plant. And what happens if you sit in a field and eat poppy plants all day long? Well, you'll fail a urine test for opium, but you're not going to become addicted. You're not going to become an itching, shriveling heroin addict. It's only when you take the inner essence of that poppy plant and refine and purify it into a light brown powder that you get the drug called heroin. Next comes sugar. Where do we get sugar? From the sugarcane plant, sugar beets, and corn. These are all foods that I myself would eat freely. Now, sugarcane is hard to come by in the Northeast, so I've never actually nibbled on it, but I do eat beets on my salad most nights. I love corn on the cob. In fact, just a ways up from my house, there's a farm stand that sells fresh corn on the cob all summer long. Yum. Not addictive. Healthy. But when you take the inner essence of those plants and you refine and purify it into a powder, or in the case of high fructose corn syrup, a thick liquid, now you have a drug. You've taken a food and you've turned it into a drug. And finally, flour. Where do we get flour? Well, from any number of plants. They all start as healthy foods in their whole form. But when you take their inner essence and you refine and purify them into a fine powdery substance, you now have a drug. If, as you read this, you feel bleak and desperate at the thought of going without sugar and flour, I just want to point out that that, right there, is dopamine downregulation talking. It's amazing how powerful the feeling can be. We think that if these foods aren't in our life, then there's nothing good to live for. I know what that feeling of bleakness feels like. You'll get through it, I promise. Dopamine receptors do regenerate. You will be fine. You'll be better than fine, in fact, because soon enough you'll be well on your way to your goal weight, much happier, more confident, and free from the damage that these substances are inflicting on your brain. A PET scan of three different brains shows the dopamine responses in each brain's nucleus accumbens. A normal brain exhibits a healthy dopamine response, represented by darker shading. The darker the shading, the stronger the neurological activity. The PET scan of the brain addicted to cocaine shows that the response is pretty muted. But the PET scan of the brain of an obese person shows little dark shading. The dopamine response is actually worse than the cocaine addicts. Now, one of the guiding principles in science is correlation doesn't prove causation. In other words, it's possible that instead of overeating causing the thinning out of the dopamine receptors, it could have been the reverse. Perhaps the obese brain demands so much food because it was born without enough dopamine receptors in the first place. Scientists continued to entertain this possibility until May of 2010, when a Scripps Research Institute paper was published in Nature Neuroscience. Dr. Paul Johnson and Dr. Paul Kenny took rats with normal, healthy brains and split them up into three groups. The control group was fed standard laboratory rat pellets. The second group was fed a diet of bacon, sausage, cheesecake, pound cake, frosting, and chocolate, but only for 1 hour each day. The third group got access to that diet for 18 to 23 hours a day, all they could eat. A rat buffet. No surprise, the third group got really obese. But more important, they started with healthy brains and ended with downregulation in their dopamine receptors. The diet caused their brains to change. Science had finally proven what anyone who has ever been in a 12-step program for food already knows. Food addiction is real. As real as cocaine addiction. As real as heroin addiction. There is no physiological difference. Initially, researchers asked, really? Food is as addictive as cocaine and heroin? But now, a lot of researchers estimate that it might be more addictive. Sugar and flour addiction. In 2007, at the University of Bordeaux, Dr. Serge H. Ahmed's team injected rats with intravenous cocaine until they were addicted. Then the team offered them something they'd never been exposed to before, sweetened water. The rats were forced to make a choice between intravenous cocaine they were already addicted to and sweetened water. It made no difference whether the sweetener was sugar or saccharin, those rats preferred the sweetened water. Based on that study, Dr. Mark Hyman estimates that sugar is 8 times more addictive than cocaine. In the Scripps Research Institute study, rodents would willingly cross and stand on an electrified floor in order to keep eating their high-sugar food. You can measure the strength of an addiction by titrating the strength of the shock that a subject will voluntarily withstand to keep consuming the substance. And the rats' levels went right up to the cocaine and heroin addiction thresholds. Another thing worth noting is that when the researchers took away this hyperpalatable food and left the rats with standard rat chow, they starved themselves. They were not interested in eating anything other than the processed, highly rewarding foods. The researchers called this the salad bar option, and the rats wanted no part of it. So how do we know which foods are addictive? Some popular researchers and authors have suggested that the addictive elements are sugar, fat, and salt. I don't agree with all three of these. First of all, to my knowledge, there is no evidence that salt is addictive. True, salt makes food more palatable, leading to the consumption of more calories. In one study, people consumed 11% more food if it was pleasantly salted. But palatable is not the same as addictive. How about fat? Well, the research here is trickier, especially since most high-fat foods also contain sugar, flour, or both. But in 2013, the landscape finally became clear. Three scientists conducted an ingenious study that pitted fat directly against sugar and watched what happened in the brains of the people who consumed different quantities of each. Researchers put subjects in an fMRI machine and measured the activity in various parts of the brain as they sucked chocolate milkshakes through straws. The levels of sugar versus fat in the milkshakes were titrated to create 4 versions. High sugar, high fat. High sugar, low fat. Low sugar, high fat. And low sugar, low fat. The results showed that it was sugar content, not fat content, that drove the response in the reward centers of the brain. Now, for me, this study went a long way toward putting the idea that fat is addictive to bed. Just like salt, fat helps make foods more palatable and will certainly drive the passive overconsumption of calories. But that doesn't mean it's addictive. For those of you who are still not convinced, let me put it another way. If you put butter and salt on broccoli, people will eat a bit more broccoli because it tastes better. But I think we can all agree that no one is going to get rich opening salted buttered broccoli drive-thrus. Another way to get clear data on this is just to ask people, as I've asked students in my psychology of eating classes, what foods do you drive out of your way to go buy? The answers? Cake. Cupcakes, cookies, candy, ice cream, donuts, chocolate, pizza, chips, pasta, bagels, bread, crackers, and pancakes. Pizza, chocolate, and chips are the top 3 most addictive foods. Why is pizza so addictive? Well, let's think about it. Pizza is made out of dough, sauce, and cheese. Sauce is yummy, and cheese can be a little addictive. There are casomorphins in cheese, which mimic an opioid response in the brain. But what happens if you put cheese and sauce on broccoli? You have a delicious side dish for your dinner, but nothing worth venturing out for in a snowstorm. It's the flour that's driving the addictive response in pizza. In fact, notice that 2 of the top 3 most addictive foods, pizza and chips, are flour-based. If you want to get happy, thin, and free, it's crucial to be clear about what the addictive foods are. Because with addiction, 1 is too many and 1,000 is never enough. Other foods are fine in moderate amounts. Fat and salt can be included in your daily diet in moderate quantities because without sugar and flour in the mix, they aren't going to derail your efforts. But add sugar or flour to the equation, and it's game over. The downregulated life. Dr. Robert Lustig of the University of California at San Francisco, one of the leading experts on